Also, an EU leader summit is due to take place here at the end of next week. Analysts are not anticipating there will be many references made to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A study presented by the Bank of Italy on Monday raised the alarm on the Italian company's sentiment on the future. According to the report, based on information gathered between August 15 and September 15, spiraling inflation and uncertainty linked to the conflict in Ukraine have badly dented optimism. The Bank of Italy surveyed companies in the industrial and service sectors with at least 50 employees.
Bank of Italy's data was somehow predictable. One just needs to talk to people to realize how worrying the situation is. Maybe we must be aware that the financialization of the economy, a long-standing issue, is aggravating the economic situation and that companies must stop seeking high profits in a short span of time.
A third of the firms surveyed said difficulties related to rising energy costs had worsened in the previous 3 months, sparking a downward revision in the investment plans for the remainder of the year. The war between Ukraine and Russia has made an Italian energy crisis much worse. Italy received 40% of its gas imports before the conflict from Russia.
We are witnessing a spike in energy prices, which is only partially due to a shortage of supplies, and also has roots in speculative strategies which threaten thousands of companies and alarm families.
The leader of a right-wing coalition that won elections about 2 weeks ago, Giorgia Meloni, is likely to become Italy's next prime minister. Meloni will face no shortage of challenges, from the budget and recovery plans to finding unity with allies and deciding how to handle the Ukraine-Russia war. So far, the Mario Draghi's government has spent 66 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. Italy's finances are set to be further put to the test as analysts predict the next government will be forced to increase fiscal aid or even to resort to a budgetary slippage. Max Civilli, Rome.
Dressed in their Sunday's best and singing words of praise, thousands of Muslims from around the world descended upon the northwest English town of Bolton to celebrate a historical figure whose legacy transcends time and space. Prophet Muhammad, his birthday called the Mawlid, celebrated in the third month of the Islamic calendar.
For these Muslims and millions of others around the world, Prophet Muhammad is an ethical and spiritual role model, and commemorating his life is another way of keeping his memory alive in the collective Muslim consciousness.
And it is that and his many other characteristics which attract these Muslims to the joyous occasion. The young are eager to tell us what the Prophet means to them.
Inspiration, and undoubtedly the most honest person you can ever think of. The best of all mankind, and the one you should actually truly believe in. Like, you can say, I believe in this person because he's a good man, good job. This person is the one you can really say, and with your heart and faith, say, I believe in him.
He means everything to me. He showed me how to live my life, how to treat other people. You know, how the way I'd want to be treated is the same way I treat other people.
As well as making the Prophet and his legacy a constant in the lives of Muslims, the event sets out to change misconceptions among non-Muslims in the wake of insults against the Prophet in Europe in recent years and increased religious hate crimes on his followers.
Our religion that the beloved Prophet Muhammad has given us is a religion of peace, love and harmony, and it's to build unity and community, to bring the communities together with love and harmony.
At the same time as their female counterparts celebrating in a nearby building, the men engage in prayers and reciting the Quran, followed by delicious free food, a symbol of the Holy Prophet's largesse. Said Puriza, Bolton.
The Silicon Valley of Iran, Paradis Technology Park, is home to heavyweight tech firms, from fintech to medical and robotics companies. The 20th Paradis Annual Summit Paradise Park acknowledged the top brands that have made major contributions to the country's economic growth.
We produce mining, drilling, and extraction machinery, including road headers, side dump loaders, conveyors, bolts, as well as junction boxes. Our products are built based on international standards. We're planning to export to other countries, starting from Turkey.
We're producing all of the supplements and medicines that have a high degree of technology based on biotechnology or human medicines, veterinary medicines, and so on.
Located in west of Tehran, Paradise Technology Park was launched in 2001 with the aim of offering financial and consulting support to small enterprises and commercializing their products. Currently, it has 400 companies under its belt, many of which have turned into tech giants.
Inside the park, we try to provide many kind of facilities and services for these companies. Some of them are professional services, including, for example, some kind of consultancies, like as legal and financial consultancies, providing some kind of services for them for...
Paradise Technology Park predicts that this year, the total export of products from its firms will hit the $50 million mark.
These companies now are exporting to more than 30 countries all over the world, and the number of products which are exporting now is more than 100 high-tech products. And this is a brilliant achievement for us in this situation, and also according to the sanction, these companies now are exporting to other countries.
With U.S. sanctions still haunting the Iranian economy, the country has in recent years attached greater significance to domestic brands. The government is increasingly supporting companies active in non-oil sectors as part of efforts to reduce its dependence on crude revenues, which have faced a slump in the wake of U.S. sanctions. Each one of these brands started out as a small startup and later grew to make a name for themselves in the market. Paradise Tech Park says it continues to support knowledge-based companies and help them develop, as it believes this will lead to a more resilient economy that will be safe from the ups and downs of the oil sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him. The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the holy book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance.
I call on the coalition of aggressors to end their war and lift the blockade and to end their occupation of our land. Just as I call on our Yemeni people to continue their resistance against our enemies for as long as their aggression continues. We consider this to be an Islamic duty and a holy war that we must commit to.
The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Thousands of Muslims have held a gathering in Pakistani capital Islamabad to celebrate the birth anniversary of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad.
The occasion is one of the key festivities on the Islamic calendar and holds a special significance for the Muslims around the world. The same goes for the people of Pakistan, who are always excited about commemorating this day.
The participants in the ceremonies say that the day provides Muslims with a great opportunity to understand the teachings and the message of Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet's teachings are still resonating in the society. This is a time to remember and follow the teachings of our Prophet and his family, who dedicated their lives for the great cause of Islam.
This day reminds us of the message of the Holy Prophet. He teaches us to forget our differences and live in peace and harmony with a sense of brotherhood.
In Islamabad, many of the public and private buildings, as well as streets, markets, and mosques, are decorated with buntings and illuminated to mark the auspicious occasion. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance. Given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing, some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him.
We are here to send a message to the world and our enemies that our Islamic nation will never abandon our beloved Prophet and that we will always follow his path and the examples of our leaders from the Prophet's household.
The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the holy book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance. The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Congratulations to all our Arabi listeners on the occasion of 17th of Rabiul Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this very auspicious occasion.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship has taken a beating since OPEC Plus decided to cut oil production by 2 million barrels. The U.S. has announced that it will reevaluate its relationship with the kingdom, such as arms sales. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the degree this relationship, to what degree this relationship has been fractured, and whether U.S. politicians will follow through with their threats, including the U.S. President Joe Biden, whose party faces the midterms on rocky grounds due to inflation and high energy prices. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hassan Ali joins us. He is a scientist, writer, and political analyst who joins us from New York. Also from New York, Daniel Lazar, journalist and author.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, Hassan Ali, let me first start with you. Maybe we can get this out of the way right from the get-go. When you take a look at the reason behind this 2 million output cut, the decision that was made by OPEC Plus, which many say Saudi Arabia leads, is that it was a necessity, given the world needs oil, especially Europe, in addition to the U.S., the counter, of course, argument against that. Was this a necessity? Or was it a political decision made by Saudi Arabia leading OPEC Plus?
Well, in my opinion, it was a political decision. First of all, in the era of the United States unipolar hegemony, the ruling classes of other nations, they were incentivized to have a comparable relationship with the imperialist power, being the U.S. In today's multipolar world, there are other relationships to be made, Russia and China, for example, and many of these are not in the best interests of the imperialist power. Moreover, the OPEC nations are quickly realizing that the U.S. can't try to boss around Russia with a proxy war, even go as far as attacking vital infrastructure. So what's stopping the U.S. from turning on other OPEC nations? So for OPEC to cut their production down, they're telling the U.S., you can't boss us around with... because the U.S. wanted to put a price cap on the oil. So to me, this is a Saudi saying, no, we're not going to put a price cap on. We're going to curtail production and try to raise their gas prices.
Well, when we take a look, Daniel Lazar, as to the statements made by the U.S. and Western countries also, but more so from the U.S., there is one way of this to have been described, and that is that OPEC Plus is using energy as a weapon. Of course, the Saudi Arabian energy minister has responded to that by saying, show me how. Do you think Saudi Arabia is using energy as a weapon?
No, I actually don't. I disagree with the other guest. I think the gesture was primarily economic. Inflation is building around the world. Oil prices had been in decline for several months. They've fallen by about a third. They had fallen by about a third. And the Saudis wanted them back up, as simple as that. They need the revenue to keep up with their development plans, whatever you think of them, but they needed the revenue, and so they decided to cut production in order to bolster prices. I mean, when the Saudis cut production back in the mid 70s, that was at the height of of U.S. domination of the global oil markets. But the Saudis didn't care. They knew they had had the leverage, and they used it to drive prices back up. And I see this as primarily economic act rather than a political act.
Why, Hassan Ali, do you think this has been described, this oil cut, as a jab and rebuke to the Biden administration? Is that what Saudi Arabia is after with this decision, given the fact that they maybe hold the most influence in OPEC Plus?
Well, I see why people call it a jab or a rebuke. When Biden was running against Trump, he used Trump's relationship with MBS as political leverage, and even sowed distrust and discontent with the Saudi government. So Biden then visited in July, and it was a well-publicized visit. It was publicized as a way to mend relationships, but I don't think it even was in that scenario, because Biden said at that time, quote, this trip is about positioning America in this region for the future. We're not going to leave a vacuum for Russia or China to fill. Now, obviously, Saudi is playing both sides. So I agree with the notion that they have economic incentive, but I also believe that they have strong, very strong political incentive. The unipolar hegemony is ending. And they have to create certain relationships with the rising powers.
Taking a look at the timing of this, Daniel Lazar, do you think that this has happened at this point if there was a political incentive because of the midterms coming up? Do you think that was something that was in Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus's calculations, maybe?
Well, I think it was certainly in the U.S. calculations. I mean, the reason that Biden went to went to Saudi Arabia in July is he wanted to talk down oil prices to strengthen his political hand in view of the upcoming midterm elections. The reason that Biden is so upset now is he thinks the Saudi increase, the OPEC Plus action, hurts him in terms of the coming midterms, and he's undoubtedly correct. In fact, it makes him look very foolish, very weak, and I think he'll pay a price at the polls. But I think the Saudis, main incentive was economic. It's not to say that they're aware that the world is a multipolar place these days. It's changing a great deal. And they're aware that they've got to position themselves vis-a-vis actors like Russia and China. And the world is getting to be a more complex place than ever was before. But then again, I just once again believe that the incentive is primarily economic. They need to bolster their revenue, and that's it. I mean, the world is being shaken by inflation. Inflation is remaking all economic relationships. It's very strong, it's very powerful, and the Saudis are trying to position themselves in terms of the growing inflationary wave and to benefit from it as best they can.
Well, since you mentioned Russia and China, I'm going to zoom in on the Russia factor here. Hassan Ali, this has been described also as an important boost to Russia. Not only that, it has been described as Saudi Arabia to have sided with Russia. Tell us whether, first of all, you agree, and why are these two angles being presented in this form and manner?
Well, first of all, the Saudis have every reason to play both sides. They don't necessarily need to play or pick one side or the other. However, even showing any sympathy towards the Russian side in this conflict is enough for the U.S. to, especially all the politicians in Washington, to be quite upset with them. Now, a lot of the left in the United States was questioning Saudi's motives for choosing Russia over the U.S., particularly because the U.S. has been funding arms to Saudi for the genocidal war against the Yemenis. However, I believe that Saudis can find their weapons elsewhere. They can find their weapons in Russia or China. And interestingly, now you're even seeing the progressives, for example, Bernie Sanders, suddenly now talk about and point to the Yemen war and the humanitarian crisis that's being caused. This is because Saudi is now shifting its military alliances away from the U.S., so now the U.S. has every reason to point to the war crimes related to it.
Well, since you are mentioning the politician there, Bernie Sanders, let's see what he has said. If Saudi Arabia, Daniel Lazar, this is for you, one of the worst violators of human rights in the world, wants to partner with Russia to jack up U.S. gas prices, it can get Putin to defend his monarchy. We must pull all U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia, stop selling them weapons, and end its price-fixing oil, as he calls cartel. We don't call it that. What do you think about Bernie Sanders' statement?
I mean, first of all, Bernie Sanders has essentially supported a U.S. imperial policy all over the world for years. I mean, he is not a critic of U.S. military policy. I think he's absolutely outrageous. I mean, to be fair, he has opposed the Yemen war, but he has also beat the drum against Russia as much as any other U.S. politician in recent years. So all Sanders is doing now is just, you know, joining, you know, you know, hopping on the bandwagon against Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is not sufficiently anti-Russian. I mean, I think it's really ridiculous, and Sanders is making a fool of himself. But it's interesting that that in Washington, you know, it's okay to kill tens of thousands of Yemenis and to destroy that society, But if you fail to get on board the American war agenda vis-a-vis Russia, then you're in big trouble.
Still kind of confused about the fact Hassan Ali, Saudi Arabia, is set to side with Russia. This is what Robert Menendez has said. He's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Aside from, I will not greenlight any cooperation with Riyadh until the kingdom reassesses its position with respect to the war in Ukraine. Then he says this has helped underwrite Putin's war through the OPEC Plus, and he calls cartel. So there's simply no room to play with when it's been being played both sides of the conflict. I mean, is that what Saudi Arabia, is that really what it is doing? Is it siding with Russia? Is it playing up the Ukraine conflict, both sides of the fence?
Well, to the imperialists, even fence-sitting is not taking a stand. I mean, of course, in my opinion, I can always argue, you know, a nation that just fence-sits and is not taking a firm stance against this proxy war in Ukraine is doing something wrong. And of course, the imperialists can take the opposite position as well, right? No one likes fence-sitters. But I totally understand Saudi's both economic and political incentives to play both sides here. But Menendez, you know, he says it very directly. He says we will not greenlight any cooperation until the kingdom reassesses its position in respect to the war in Ukraine. That's the main impetus for the U.S. government right now.
Looking at what seems to be the repeated rhetoric coming from the U.S. through its politicians, Daniel Lazar, is the fact that they want there to be a either pause or a complete stop to what they call the transfer of American warfare, including technology. This is something that has been said before. U.S. has threatened Saudi Arabia before with this, but it hasn't really happened, has it? I mean, even no. Biden wrote on that in his during his candidacy for presidency of the U.S. Why is it that they fail to follow through with this? Is it because they can't stop in terms of the money they're making, or what is the story here?
Well, there are a multitude of reasons. I mean, first of all, the U.S.-Saudi alliance goes back nearly 80 years. I mean, Saudi Arabia is America's oldest ally in the Middle East, even before the U.S.-Israeli alliance. Saudi Arabia is an extremely important market for U.S. weapons sales. That's it's hugely important to the arms industry, and the U.S. just can't walk away from an outlet like that. But also the U.S. wants to maintain control of the Persian Gulf. It wants to control the energy markets. And it can't do that without having some kind of working relationship with Saudi Arabia. Now, that relationship has come under strain, at many points over the past decades, most especially in the wake of 9/11, where clearly, elements of the Saudi royal family were implicated. But nonetheless, the U.S. just can't walk away from that relationship, and I doubt it will now.
Can Saudi Arabia walk away from that relationship, Hassan Ali?
I think we're reaching an era in which they could. I don't think we're necessarily near that moment just yet. I will say again that the OPEC nations are seeing very clearly that the U.S. will go to extreme measures to exert their control over oil and energy. I think Saudi's still in a time where they can continue to play both sides and maybe even swing back to a pro-U.S. side, right? They don't necessarily have to abandon the U.S. permanently at this moment. But I do agree that a time will come where Saudi and other nations have the power to step away from the relationship with the U.S. if it serves their own interest.
Well, some may say the time is now. I mean, we're looking at the shift that's happening, Daniel Lazar. We're looking at the fact that obviously the Biden administration, particularly Joe Biden, is not really favored in the kingdom. And at this point in time, even the Saudis have come out, believe it or not, making statements against the U.S., of which that was pretty interesting based on some of the reporting, which it says the current reactions, consider them to be angry responses only because of the high prices of oil, which exceeded 9%, so they find themselves a way out of what is happening, is what some are saying. Now, Is there a possibility that Saudi Arabia wants to limit its relationship with the U.S.? Is there a transformation taking place as we speak?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair to say. I think the Saudis want to control the relationship a bit more. I mean, look at the Saudis were angry at the high-handed U.S. approach, in the wake of incidents like the Khashoggi murder, the Yemen war. The U.S. has talked down to the Saudis on many occasions. It's behaved in a very bossy, authoritarian manner, and that angered the Saudis. And the Saudis, therefore, when they had the leverage, they felt they were in a position to push back against the United States. They did so. So that's understandable. I mean, there is a certain political dimension to this conflict, and the Saudis want to rebalance the relationship, I would say. But I still am quite confident that the U.S., that the Saudis and the U.S. are closely joined. The Saudi military is highly dependent on U.S. weaponry, and I think the relationship will continue. I mean, I think it's a very bad thing. I think it's a disaster for the Middle East, but I'm quite confident the relationship will continue despite this latest bump in the road.
So you have this oil cut that has been announced, Hassan Ali, but at the same time, you have Saudi Arabia who has said, we will maintain oil deliveries to Asia despite the OPEC plus cuts. At least seven customers, Saudi Arabia said, on the Asian continent will receive full contract volumes of crude oil in November, ahead of the winter peak season. What do you think? Isn't that a shift away from the U.S. then with that type of approach?
It's hard to say if it's a decisive shift because, again, I repeat that they have every incentive to play both sides here. I mean, even the democratic establishments who are threatening to pull arms from them in response to that, I think it's a bluff. I think our other guest here is right that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is very strong for now. There's no reason to break it. The U.S. does not want these sales going out to the other Asian countries, especially because the cuts to the West and more sales to the East are resulting in deindustrialization in the West and an intensification of industrialization in the East. For the working people of the West, this is bad, and for the working people of Asia, this is good. And something bad for the working people will only result in political unrest. So this decision of Saudi to continue production, exporting energy out, allowing for production to increase, is only going to harm the political establishment of the West.
Mm-hmm. Can't help but think about what the former U.S. President Donald Trump said, Daniel Lazar, at one point, and that was back when Jamal Khashoggi was assassinated with the orders to have been given, according to the CIA anyways, by the Saudi Crown Prince. And basically, when the news broke out, he said, no, it can't be. There's not enough proof. And as we days and somewhat weeks went by, he finally reached the point where he had to say why he's not condemning the Saudi Crown Prince. And he said, look, if we were to do anything against Saudi Arabia, then there will be eager sellers of arms. And it mentioned Russia right away and other arms manufacturers that are very eager to sell to Saudi Arabia. Is this what's driving this relationship?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's a very important element. And I think that, I think there isn't that much difference between Trump and Biden on this question. I mean, Biden, values the Saudi as an outlet for U.S. arms. He also values them as an ally in the Persian Gulf area, and so therefore it's a very important alliance. It's a cornerstone of U.S. Middle East policy, and I think that essentially Trump, Biden, they both agree that this relationship is a very important one, and the U.S. is not going to respond in a precipitous manner to this latest price hike. There'll be some arguing back and forth. There'll be a small amount of turbulence, but I really believe both sides will step in to calm things down eventually to reestablish relations, to rebalance relations. And I expect the U.S.-Saudi alliance to continue despite this latest perturbation.
Well, the whole thing about supply and demand in this case and at this point in juncture, Hassan Ali, of what we're looking at is not something that is going to be short-lived. We're looking at a conflict that is probably going to keep dragging out. We're looking at 2023 based on the, either, I don't know who you'd like to use as a reference, the World Bank, IMF, or are they all Washington-based, so it doesn't matter. It's the same source. But anyways, you know, this demand side is still going to continue. If we're looking at the threat that Joe Biden has just placed, this just came in a couple hours back, where he says that I will enact anti-Saudi Arabia legislation once I get back from the western part of the U.S. I forget for what reasons he's there. And Saudi Arabia basically is on the track where they are rejecting all threats of economic sanctions or political pressure or false accusations, and they said that they will respond with greater action. So if they're going to respond with greater action, that's going to leave not only the U.S., but the world on the western side out in the cold. Do you think that that's the trajectory we're on right now?
Well, I'll say that small political turbulences, even if they can be resolved even within a year or 2 years, they will have long-lasting ramifications. Like I said before, the United States has already deindustrialized, and now with these energy cuts, Europe is also heading towards that direction. There's going to be mass political discontent. You know, when people's heating is cut off in their homes, when factories are shut down due to energy costs, no one's going to be blaming Russia or Saudi Arabia or China. They're all going to be blaming their own governments. And you know, we see the rise of nationalist leadership in various Western states for that exact reason.
Daniel, as our final question to you, come midterms, November 4th or 10th, I forget, and let's say the Republicans take over, do you think Saudi Arabia will change its tune?
No, I think that's a good question. I first of all, the Saudis already promised to increase production next month after cutting back this month, number one. Number two, the Saudis... I think probably lean more in favor of the Republicans at this point. And the Saudis would be very happy to see Donald Trump back in the White House. So I think that they are maybe hoping that'll come to pass. And I think that the Republicans, okay, if they take control of Congress, will not move to further disturb U.S.-Saudi relations.
Thank you. We're fresh out of time. Thank you so much. Our guests, both from New York, Hassan Ali, scientist, writer, and political analyst. A pleasure. Daniel Lazar, thank you so much. Journalist and author, again, both from New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In Britain, the Institute for Fiscal Studies says Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget will leave ministers making serious reductions in public services. We have taken a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more on this story. Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng will need to find £60 billion of savings by 2026 to fill the gap left by unfunded tax cuts and the costs of extra borrowing, triggered by a panic reaction on international money markets to the Chancellor's mini-budget, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies. The United Kingdom will also struggle to hit the Chancellor's 2.5% economic growth target, with economic forecasts by the investment bank Citigroup and the Institute for Fiscal Studies uses to underpin its analysis showing the United Kingdom will struggle to grow at more than 0.8% on average over the next 5 years. That sluggish economic growth rate, thanks to a toxic cocktail of a slowing global economy, the UK's weakened trade balance after Brexit, and the fallout from the mini-budget, would be slightly less than half the growth rate forecast by the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, back in March. The £45 billion cost of the mini-budget will wipe out any financial space left to the Chancellor by his predecessor, swelling Britain's debt as a share of national income for at least the next 5 years. The Institute for Fiscal Studies director Paul Johnson said that while it was technically possible for Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng to balance the books via spending cuts, he warned public sector spending had already suffered a huge hit over the last decade and that there was not much fat left to cut. In 2026, the government is likely to still be borrowing £100 billion a year, when previous forecasts showed it falling to nearer £30 billion, the Institute for Fiscal Studies said. A proportion of the rise in borrowing is accounted for by the energy price cap that ministers agreed to maintain the average household bill at £2,500 a year. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said the cost of the package was likely to be lower than the £150 billion expected by the Treasury at about £114 billion, though it will still add to the avalanche of unfunded proposals put forward to boost economic growth. Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng and Prime Minister Liz Truss have argued that their policies of tax cuts and deregulation will improve the business environment and boost profits, lifting tax revenues to pay for state services. However, the Institute for Fiscal Studies said government plans to inject vigour into Britain's economy over the next 5 years to pay for a boost in spending were likely to have only a limited effect, leaving ministers to make hefty reductions in public services and to keep a tight rein on welfare benefits. The Chancellor has announced a 1 pence cut in the basic rate of income tax from next April, and a reduction in national insurance contributions by 1.25 percentage points. In addition, he plans to freeze corporate tax at 19%, costing an estimated £19 billion, compared with a previous plan to raise the rate to 25%. The Institute for Fiscal Studies director, Paul Johnson, said all the options open to Kwasi Kwarteng were unpalatable, as they either increased the public deficit or, to avoid this, involved swinging cuts to public spending or broke manifesto commitments. The BBC has more on the same story. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, will need to make big and painful spending cuts to put the country's finances on a sustainable path, the Institute for Fiscal Studies think tank has warned. With a weaker economy and promised tax cuts, there will be a large shortfall in revenues, the Institute for Fiscal Studies predicts. It calculates the government would have to spend £60 billion a year less by 2026-2027. However, the Treasury said its tax cuts and reforms would deliver sustainable funding for public services. In a new report, the Institute for Fiscal Studies outlines the scale of the cuts necessary to make the sums add up over the next 5 years, using an illustrative example. It suggests Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng could increase working age benefits in line with average earnings, rather than inflation, for 2 years to save £13 billion. Limit public investment to 2% of national income to save another £14 billion. Cut the budgets of every government department except health and defence by 15% to save around £35 billion. Kwasi Kwarteng and Prime Minister Liz Truss have argued focusing on measures to promote growth will help plug the shortfall between income and outgoings. The Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, has promised to set out further details of his economic strategy on 31st of October, 3 weeks earlier than originally planned, alongside a full forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR. The change of timetable came after the markets balked at the strategy announced in last month's mini-budget. It outlined large tax cuts and a huge package of support with energy costs without details of how they would be paid for and without the usual assessment of their impact from the Office of Budget Responsibility, the OBR. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, a politically independent economics-focused think tank, has published its own assessment of the Chancellor's strategy in what it names a green budget after a consultation green papers issued in Parliament. It calculates the Chancellor would have to cut spending on benefits, public services and investment sharply if he wants to stick to his commitment to balance the budget in medium term, rather than see debt continuing to rise. The Institute for Fiscal Studies Director Paul Johnson said, "The Chancellor says he wants to get the public finances on a sustainable basis. It looks to us like that's going to mean tens of billions of pounds of spending cuts in order to achieve that. It's hard to see what other way out the Chancellor has." The Institute for Fiscal Studies Director, Paul Johnson, said the country was not going into a period with much fat to trim. "One of the problems the government faces is we have had a decade and more of really tight spending settlements. We're still spending less on a lot of public services than we were just over a decade ago." Cutting public sector pay, benefits, education, justice and prisons would all be very difficult against that backdrop, he said.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.